working or it's not?
Yeah.
How about that? I can just yell, but some people won't like that. That's the civil litigation system. Any questions? Okay, it's the end of the exam. So I thought that before we get into this, it might be helpful to understand the system as a whole. Everybody thinks differently. I'm a visual thinker. So when I'm working, I tend to draw a lot of diagrams and flow charts and timelines and things like that. It just helps me. And so I kind of present things the way it's meaningful to me. If it's not meaningful to you, then tell me and I'll try to do it a different way so that you understand that. I think it's important to understand the system as a whole and to not get too carried away with preconceptions, misconceptions about how it operates. Ultimately, this system is about fairness, about parties going to court and being able to put evidence and legal arguments before a judge, or perhaps a judge and a jury, and have them resolve the dispute on the merits. The rules of civil procedure formalize a process, but that process can be adjusted based on the consent of the parties or the order of the court, or clarified. Sometimes it's a little bit more rigid, sometimes it's very, very flexible. So sometimes judges will say to the lawyers, like, you know, if you want to do this differently, if you want this trial to be conducted differently, you just tell me. As long as everybody agrees on what the rules are going to be, and they're represented by counsel, then sure, I'll do whatever you want. Doesn't matter to me. I mean, if you think it's cheaper and easier and more expeditious and all the rest of it to do it this way, we'll do it that way. If not, then there is a system that I'm going to follow. And so the system of civil procedure that's set out in the rules of civil procedure that we're going to be studying with sets out this system. But don't get carried away with thinking that it's like criminal law, and if you don't follow a procedure or somebody misses a timeline or something is irregular, then the whole thing gets blown up. These are disputes between people, not between the person and the crown who's alleging wrongdoing. That's a very different process. So generally speaking, there are different stages. You know, a person comes to see you in your office and they're going to talk to you about what their complaint is, what their claim is, what their injury is, what they want to have done. So the, you know, can I sue? And the answer is going to be always, of course you can sue. What do you think I do all day long? Of course, be happy to assist you, or oh, you have no claim and you're going to be wasting your money. We will be looking at jurisdiction very briefly. Most of the time, jurisdiction is not about the problem, but sometimes it can be. So the question becomes, if I can sue, where should I bring my claim? Like, is Ontario, our jurisdiction, the right place to litigate, or should I be going to another province or another country or somewhere else and be suing there? And there are some rules. This is an area called conflicts of law. And so we're just going to do jurisdiction and some minor conflict issues. I don't know if conflict is being offered right now. If you're interested in sort of like transnational commercial dealings, litigation, planning, whatever, then I would suggest that you do take the course in conflict, because then questions of jurisdiction become important. In a contract, you can specify what jurisdiction disputes are going to be resolved in and what the governing law can be, but when it comes to tort claims, or if the contract doesn't specify, or there's equitable wrongs or other things, then jurisdiction does become an important feature. So, can I sue? Is this the place to sue? Great, we're going to sue in Ontario. So there are basically three major stages in litigation. The first is pleadings. And when we say pleadings, these are the documents that are exchanged between the parties and filed with the court. And the easiest way to understand it is, it's kind of like an indictment in criminal law, where you have a series of allegations of fact which the Crown seeks to prove. Well, it's the same thing here. The parties are going to present a picture which they want to have a court accept, which they say entitles them to a remedy. You have to be able to state with particularity what the facts are that entitles you to something so that the other side can respond effectively. And so we'll be looking at what pleadings are all about, what has to be in them, what kinds of pleadings there are, how you amend pleadings, can they be struck out, are they adequate, inadequate. It's a big deal. There are two streams that are available under the rules of civil procedure. There's something called an action, which is what most litigation is, and there's something called an application. An action leads to a trial with witnesses that are being examined in court, in principle. That's what an action is. When you think about suing people, normally you're thinking about an action. The pleadings in an action are a statement of claim, which is what the plaintiff serves, a statement of defense, defendant's position, and then the plaintiff being entitled to reply. It's a little bit more complicated because the defendant might sue the plaintiff at the same time, so there's a counterclaim, or they might, one of the parties might sue a third party, so there's a claim, a cross claim, or a third party claim. We'll deal with that. It gets a little bit more complicated when you have multi-party cases. But in principle, you know, plaintiff, defendant, they exchange documents. And those documents are what they hope to prove. And so oftentimes when you read the statement of claim or statement of defense, it's kind of over the top. Well, that's because that's what they're hoping to prove. It's not necessarily what they're going to do. These documents are important because they set out what the scope of the contest is. Once you know what the scope of the contest is, you can say, well, what are the legal issues? What evidence would be relevant and not relevant? And then what procedures are appropriate to be able to resolve this dispute? An application is sort of different in nature. Theoretically, an application should be used where the facts are less contested, and it's more of a legal issue, but I don't think that that distinction really is true in practice. Many things have to proceed by way of application. The rules or a statute will say, but you may apply to the court. And oftentimes in applications, it's that the court is required to resolve the dispute in some way. It's not just the parties are going to settle between themselves. You may need a judge to actually offer a discretionary remedy or, you know, do something that a statute demands that the court do in order for the case to be resolved. The pleadings in an application are different than in an action. So it starts with what's called a notice of application. And this notice of application is kind of like a statement of claim. It'll say, this is what the party is applying for. Here's the people that are the respondents, not the defendants. So there's applicants and respondents rather than plaintiffs and defendants. This is what the applicant wants. These are the facts that the applicant is going to rely upon. And then they serve it on the other side, file it with the court, and it gets things going. So pleadings, action, application. We're going to deal with this in detail, so you don't need to worry about any of this. Where there's an action, the rules prescribe what happens next. You don't really need to go to court to get orders necessarily. So that the pleadings will say, or the rules will say, that once a statement of claim is issued, it has to be served a certain amount of time. The defendant has a certain amount of time to put in their statement of defense. There can be a reply. Now there's going to be a next stage of information exchange. So, and we call that discovery. This is the most complicated, most fought after, most expensive, most difficult part of the process. And it's usually before, during, or immediately after the case is settled. our rules of civil procedure say you have to show the other side every document that you have in your possession or under your control that's relevant, that's not privileged. In other words, you have to drop your pants and you have to show them everything. The evidence that's good for you, the evidence that's bad for you. No trial by ambush. If you don't show the other side the documents that you're going to rely upon, the evidence that you're going to rely upon, you're not going to be able to call it a trial. So there is a really formal way of resolve of doing this. The first stage is there's something called an affidavit of documents that's prepared. And that's probably what you're going to be doing with our legal students. You go through your client's documents, what they have and what they can get that's relevant. You separate out things that are privileged that can't be compelled to be produced. You create an affidavit, a sworn statement for the client, and then you list all of the documents and make them available to the other side, and they do the same. Now you know what the evidence that they have is, and they know what the evidence that you have is. And so both parties can now assess the strengths and the weaknesses of their case and consider settlement. After there's completion of this process, which is called documentary discovery, then each side, with some restrictions, has the ability to compel the other side to attend for examination for discovery, which is an oral examination under oath in a court reporter's office, where the other side gets to ask you questions, or your client questions, about anything that's relevant. And the rules of evidence are much more relaxed here because the transcript is not admissible in evidence except for where a person gives evidence at trial that's inconsistent with their examination transcript, their discovery transcript. Now you can cross-examine them on prior inconsistent statement, which goes to their credibility. And so the rules of evidence are more relaxed at the discovery stage because the whole point is to be able to hoover up as much information as possible, to be able to understand what your opponent's case is, and then discover evidence that helps you. And so each side will have a chance to discover the other side's party, the other side's clients, or the principal parties. And that it's a really, there's a lot that's involved in this. It's time restricted. You only get a certain amount of hours of discovery time. It can be extended by the court, and it's a big deal. Anybody ever been examined for discovery? Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was cool. I didn't get to do anything. I just got to see it.
Can I ask you questions about it?
Yeah.
You don't have to answer.
Okay.
So, were you a party, or were you a third party that was being examined for discovery?
Like, what do you mean?
Were you a plaintiff or a defendant?
We were a defendant.
Who's we? Were you working for somebody or was
yeah,
it you?
Right.
Okay, cool. Somebody else had their hand lined up.
We were plaintiffs.
You were plaintiffs?
I was just a student chaplain.
Okay. And so both of you were examined under oath? No?
No.
You just prepared the documents and did that? Okay, cool. Anybody get be examined under oath? Yeah?
It was horrible.
It was horrible? Can I ask questions about it?
Yeah.
Was it a discovery or cross-examination?
It was discovery.
And you, is it a matter that involved you personally or where you were representing somebody?
No, it was personally because it was a family matter, so that's why I got really vicious.
Welcome to my world. And you were examined for discovery?
Mm-hmm.
How long were you examined for?
I was a minor, so there were rules about how long I could sit.
You were examined for discovery as a minor? Oh my god, I wish I could ask you a question. That's so unusual. How long did it take to take?
I think overall, it was 4 hours.
I'm really hesitant to ask more questions. How old were you at the time?
I was 16, I wasn't so old enough to know everything, but I was just a minor for the situation.
And were you represented by the children's lawyer or by a lawyer directly?
A lawyer directly. My parents got me a lawyer.
And did they protect you?
You don't have to
No, no, like, it was fine. Like, it wasn't a criminal matter or anything. Like,
oh, no, no. No, no, it was a civil matter, yeah. Family matter. That's fine.
They did a good job.
Do you feel that your lawyer protected you during the proceedings?
Yeah, it just got vicious because there was family stuff. Like, they did a good job protecting me for the most part.
Wow. And you didn't enjoy it?
No.
Yeah. Did they ask you lots of personal questions?
Yeah.
It is the most unenjoyable feeling. They can ask you anything that's relevant. And they will. They'll ask you anything, no matter how intimate it is. It doesn't matter. You've got to answer. And ask you about other people. And it really becomes, it's extremely intrusive. And it can be used to bully people. To try to tell them, if you go to trial, this is going to get a lot worse, and I'm going to embarrass you, and I'm going to pull information out of you that you don't want to give me. It is brutal. If it's a commercial dispute and contract or whatever, not so bad. But it can be absolutely brutal because you're being asked questions like people are, it's a legal colonoscopy. And there's nothing you can do about it, but just try to relax and answer the question. Wow, I wish I could ask you a question. For a minor to be discovered is very unusual. Like, I would tell, if I was representing a minor and somebody served what's called a notice of examination, I would tell them to put them into a small ball and they could stick it wherever they want, but I'm not producing my client within the judge's order. And that's all there is to it. And when I get to court, the judge says, well, why do you want to discover a minor? What do you have in your mind? I'm not putting the minor through this. Ask them written questions, they'll give you a written answer, that's all there is to it, but, you know. That's discovery. With a notice of application, it's a little different. A notice of application and an application, in theory, what's going to happen is, at the end, you're not going to have a trial with live witnesses. You're going to have a paper trial with transcripts. And so, the rules are a little bit more flexible. And they have to be tailored to the individual case. And so after a notice of application is served on the other side, usually the next stage is a motion for what's called an order giving directions. That is a judge's order directing the parties to do things according to a timeline, maybe making available orders to obtain documents from third parties that otherwise wouldn't produce them, waive confidentiality obligations, waive solicitor client privilege in some cases. Then there is an exchange of what are called application records. An application record, a responding record. These are affidavits. Affidavits that are going to be relied upon by the party to prove their case. So now, instead of getting to the next stage and getting discovery, once you've served all of the affidavits that you're going to rely upon, there's cross-examination. Again, in a court reporter's office, but now this is evidence that's going to go before the court, and the rules of evidence are not relaxed. The exact same rules that govern in a trial, bars on hearsay, you know, things like that, all of that is what guides the questioning at cross-examination. The transcript of the cross-examination is evidence that's filed before the court. Expert evidence is a little bit different. Expert evidence usually comes in later in the process, and the reason is that experts give opinions, and normally their opinions are based on either facts that are presumed to be true or the evidence that's been given. And so if you really want to have the expert evidence have an impact, you're going to get the expert report after discovery or after cross-examinations. And you can give all of that evidence to the expert, and now the expert can say, okay, assuming that this evidence is true, and this is the evidence in detail, so I'll assume these facts, or I'll assume something or other. Now I'm going to give you my expert opinion. And that opinion will then be, we'll look at that. There has to be a special a certificate, basically an oath and acknowledgement that the expert is impartial.
The report is served on the other side, and often the expert is then examined for discovery or cross-examined later in the process. And so at this point, now that the evidence is complete, it's probably, that initial meeting was probably 2 years ago, and it's probably taken about 2 years to get through to the stage where the evidence is complete, assuming that the matter hasn't settled. There's now going to be what's called a pretrial conference. This is a judge that's not going to hear the matter, but is going to assist the parties either in settlement. So the pretrial judge will lean on the lawyers to see if we can settle the matter now, or to assist the parties in each other conceding facts or conceding the authenticity of documents, or resolving procedural or evidential issues so that the trial is much more efficient. And so the pretrial judge, you have to create the documents, the pretrial conference brief, and the judge will work with the lawyers in chambers, and at the end of the pretrial conference, the judge will give an order allowing the registrar of the court to list the matter for trial for a certain amount of time. The lawyers might say, we need 10 days, Your Honor, and the trial judge will say, well, I'm going to give you 4, so you're going to have to think about how you present your case and try to efficiently use time. And I'm going to set out in an order your different concessions that you've made or whatever, and now it's going to end up going further into the process where it'll be able to put on what's called a trial list, and you'll get a trial date. We'll deal with that. It's a little bit of a rigmarole depending on what jurisdiction the suit is in. And then it will go to trial or to a hearing. Once you get to this stage, your trial judge, or as it's called, your application judge, is the monarch of their court. And at that point, they can say, well, hang on, I don't care what the pretrial judge said, or I don't care about what you said. I want to hear this, or I want this to happen in this order, and I'm going to do it for efficiency's sake. Normally, at this point, judges don't want to do anything that's going to lead to an appeal, so they'll always ask the lawyers for submissions on any point. So I have this habit of always going, like, do you have any questions? Any submissions on that? Like, I've gotten used to this over like many, many years for being in court, because judges will always say, before I do anything else, like, do you have any submissions on this point? Like, do you have anything to say, anything else I should know? Because I'm going to make a decision and you're going to be stuck with this decision. So tell me what you want to tell me now so I can make sure I make the right one. If I don't ask you for submissions, that might lead to an appeal. The judges are going to be very careful at the beginning of the trial when they organize things to make sure things are going to happen in the right order. No one's going to be surprised. There's not going to be any procedural problems. We're going to do this nice and efficiently, and at the end of it, there'll be a result. In a trial, the witnesses appear in court. They're examined and cross-examined and re-examined before the trial court. In an application, there's a hearing, and the application judge will normally only have paper, a factum, the application record, and there might be a number of them, an application record, a supplementary application record, the respondents, the same thing, the cross-examination transcripts, the expert reports, the cross-examination of the experts, and now counsel will just lead the court through their case. You know, there'll be a factum, a trial factum, which will summarize what the evidence is, summarize what the legal position issues are, set out what the law is and what it is that you want. And then it's just a very lengthy presentation before the court going through all of the evidence to establish what the facts should be, what the issues of law are, what's the governing law, and why I should get what I want. So it's like an address to the court, but it's a lengthy address. It could take an hour, it could take a week. Depends on the type of case. At the end of it, you have a judge that's going to give a judgment. there is something that's kind of in between, and we'll deal with this. It's, there's a rule that's really important. It's called summary judgment. And this is for actions where, as the rules say, that you don't need a trial to dispose of things. It can be disposed of in another way. And that, and there's a bunch of provisions, including what we call a hybrid trial, which is part on paper, part for witnesses. And so you might have something that consists of some affidavits and cross-examination transcripts, and some witnesses being heard in open court. Even where there's an application, a trial judge might say, there are issues here, there's a dispute about facts, and there are issues of credibility. I want to hear witnesses in open court. So, you know, you put in an affidavit, they've been cross-examined, I have those transcripts, lovely. However, just like a conventional trial, I want you to call your witnesses, they'll be examined, cross-examined, and re-examined in court before me. And I'm going to set out which witnesses I want to hear. Because credibility becomes important, the judges are going to see them in open court and want to see how they respond to the questions and also actually have the opportunity to ask the questions themselves. You might have a jury for an action. Very restrictive rights to a jury in Ontario. We used to have a lot of civil jury trials, but the powers that be in their infinite wisdom said that it's too expensive. And so now, jury trials are very, very infrequent outside of personal injury actions. My personal injury actions are allowed to have jury trials, and the rest of us can't have jury trials. I don't understand. I get that it's expensive, but you either believe in juries or you don't. And then, after you get all of this, you'll get a judgment back, and the unhappy party that's paid all this money to get to this point is probably going to appeal. And like, if you've gotten to this point and you've discussed settlement and all the rest of it, and everybody said, no, we're going to go to trial, you kind of know that the party that lost is going to appeal to the Court of Appeal or to the Division of Appeal, depending on the kind of matter it is, and we'll deal with that. At any stage, including at the beginning or in the middle of the trial, or right even before some unusual cases, before the pleadings are actually started, you can have what are called motions. Motions are proceedings within a proceeding. There's a formalized process for this too. You serve, it's dealt with kind of like an application. You serve a notice of motion with a motion record that consists of affidavit evidence. The other side serves a responding record. Usually you have to get an order giving directions as well. There may or may not be cross-examinations depending on what type of motion it is. The judge will dispose of the motion, and then you can possibly have an appeal as well. Motions would normally be brought on procedural grounds. Is this really an action, or should it be an application? If it's an application, can I have it converted into an action, or the other way around? But sometimes the process is better for one for the other. If you have an allegation of fraud in an application, the other side might say, I'd like to have it converted into an action and force you to plead what the fraud is with specificity. I'll talk about that, but there can be a motion about that, or a motion about the adequacy of the pleadings, or to get further information, which we call particulars. Or there might be multiple orders giving direction, each one of which requires a motion to be brought, or motions to obtain third-party records, or discover third parties, whatever. Motions about, is this the right time for discovery, or do you discover the right people? Do you want more time? Has a party that's being examined refused to answer questions, and so we have what's called a refusals motion, and now a court is going to rule as to whether the evidence that's being sought is admissible or not, whether the questions are permissible or not, and then whether you have to answer the questions or refuse the questions. Are these really experts, not experts? Motions there. And motions here, depending on the process, evidence, whatever the case may be.
Motions can be the most significant part of the litigation, because a well-timed motion may resolve an issue by saying, this key piece of evidence is just not admissible. Or there actually isn't a controversy on some issue, and I want to have a ruling from the court on something. And now that you have clarity, the parties are going to settle very quickly, because now the one party is clearly going to win and the other party is clearly going to lose, and now they're going to resolve their differences rather than going on. So the rules that we are looking at are how this process operates and where it's necessary to clarify the application of a rule, or where a party is not complying with the rule, to compel them to comply with the rule. It's expensive because an overly aggressive litigant can bring motions all over the place just to wear the other side down. Or a litigant that's self-represented and is just doesn't know what they're doing and constantly does things that they shouldn't be doing, but not to respond to their motions or whatever it is that they're doing, costs a fortune. So motions can add a huge amount. When you talk about civil procedure then, or how a trial gets resolved or conducted and how a dispute gets resolved, it's a pretty complicated process. And it's not like television or, I'm going to say, the more I talk about the United States, I end up being very dismissive. And I'm sorry if you're American. But I don't understand American law at all. I just don't get it. I don't know if you've been following the Trump trial in New York, the fraud trial. Years ago, you're too young, with the O.J. Simpson trial was on television. For a year, it was on television. And everybody I knew, they were all lawyers, were kind of glued to it at night, because no one could believe what was going on. Like, lawyers criticizing the judge, lawyers accusing each other of wrongdoing in open court. Like, things where, if you did this in a Canadian court, you would be disbarred in about 10 minutes. This is like, no rules, absolutely no rules. In this fraud trial in New York for Trump, I'm absolutely amazed at how the lawyers are able to conduct themselves, how the parties are able to conduct themselves in a way where a Canadian judge would not tolerate this for a second. The idea that you can, in the newspaper, start accusing the judge or the other side of like a conspiracy to against the administration of justice, like when you walk into court the next day, the judge is going to say, you better have a notice of motion on abuse of process with evidence, or else you're going to be in big trouble. Otherwise, I don't want to hear you say another word about this again, and you're going to get sanctioned if you do. Like, our rules of civil procedure and our courtroom procedure does not allow for any of this nonsense that goes on in the United States. If you try those games in the Canadian court, you will be slung out on your ear in 10 seconds, and the judge will order a transcript to be sent to the disciplinary committee of the Law Society. That's not how this works. It's a brutal system, but you as lawyers have to treat each other with respect and have to be deferential and respectful to the judge. It only works if people keep to the rules. If people don't keep to the rules, then it becomes a free-for-all and becomes much more expensive. When we talk about access to justice and the adversarial principle, bear in mind this whole system works based on the presumption, based on the direction that the parties act adversarially. That is, they act in their own self-interest. They can cooperate with the other side if they want, but they don't have to. We assume that if you're going to court and suing somebody, you're going to act in your own best interests. That means you're going to put the best witnesses, the best arguments, the best evidence. And the court, in theory, will then have the best picture from one side, the best picture from the other side, and now can find the facts and apply the law in a way that makes sense. So the adversarial principle is not about cheating. It's not about accusing the other side of wrongdoing. It's not about telling the judge that they're biased because of the way they, what political party they belong to, or some kind of nonsense. It's about using the rules and bringing the best evidence in a way that that furthers the interests of your client. But it's a brutal process, because at every stage, the parties can fight, you know? Is the statement of claim good enough? Is it not good enough? Should it be struck out? Should you add to it? Should there be a... You can fight at every stage based on the rules and cause the cost to go way up. Next class we'll talk about professionalism. As lawyers, particularly as litigation lawyers, the rules of professional conduct should be kind of on your desk somewhere. Because the one thing you don't want to do is you don't want to violate the rules of professional conduct, because you can be sanctioned. It's not a free-for-all. The adversarial principle demands that you do anything that you can do lawfully, ethically, in terms of professional ethics, to further your client's interests. But you can't act improperly, either professionally or if you look at the rules of the criminal code, or you know, anything else. There are really quite severe restrictions on what you're allowed to do. How am I doing so far? Questions so far? Yeah?
Can you explain the relationship between the adversarial principle and the two other, the two other things you're talking about last class, so a mediation, I'm blanking on.
A mediation and?
It was mediation.
Arbitration.
And arbitration.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Thank you.
Resolving a dispute requires a process. This is the litigation process, where you place the dispute before the court to be resolved, and depending on what court you're in and what kind of dispute it is, there's a process to be followed. And the parties are adversarial,
mm-hmm.
and the lawyers can then tailor the process that meets their client's needs, take advantage of the procedures that are available to them to further their case, and put themselves in a position to have their client's claim be successful at trial. Complicated system. Very, very expensive. Very expensive. No matter how much you think it's going to be, double it. That's how much it's going to cost. No one has control. Takes all of the parties. All the parties can twist things around. Brutal. Absolutely brutal way of resolving a dispute. Slow, cumbersome, very expensive because of the cost rules, very risky, and you're dealing with humans.
Mm-hmm.
You're putting in front of a judge. And judges are just schnook law students with 30 years experience. And maybe they get it right, and maybe they don't. And you have to go to appeal, and you might have to start at some point further in the back in the process and do certain steps. Not the best way of resolving disputes. Slow, cumbersome, expensive. Anxiety, pressure, open to manipulation, disparity of arms, all the rest of it. Maybe necessary. Maybe appropriate for the parties. Maybe you have really good lawyers that can manage this efficiently, so actually it isn't a meat grinder, but you get from here to trial in three easy steps, and it's not going to take a year and a half, and only it's going to take 6 months. Like, that'd be wonderful. You may not want to have this process to resolve this dispute. So we can't offer trial by combat. I often suggest mud wrestling between the clients, but people don't take me up on that. I think it would be entertaining for lawyers anyways. You know, snake pit. Whoever gets out of snake pit first wins, that would be good. Those things have fallen out of fashion. Instead, we can have negotiation. Let's sit down and talk and see if we can resolve the dispute. Or we can have a more formalized negotiation, which we call a mediation. Now the parties can say, let's design a process that works for us. Let's choose a mediator, a person that's neutral. They're not invested in who wins, who loses. The mediator, the first thing they're going to say is, congratulations for coming to mediation. You've shown you're smart. The point here is not to be right. The point here is to stop the litigation and to settle your dispute because it's in everybody's interest to do so. So if you come to mediation, you're here to compromise. You're here to compromise. Hopefully what's going to happen at the end of this day is we're all going to sign a piece of paper in the end, which we call minutes of settlement, and everybody's going to go home angry. That's the sign of a good settlement. Everybody's upset, except for the mediator. Everybody's upset. Both sides think they got ripped off. Perfect. Great settlement. When somebody goes home happy and somebody goes home angry, not a great settlement. Mediation is a facilitated negotiation. And the mediator can be very helpful because you choose the right mediator. That person can look parties in the eye and say, I've looked at your case, and you're dreaming if you think you're going to win. Or you're dreaming if you think you're going to get more than 50 grand. Not going to happen. So I'm not going to say this to the other side, but I'm going to tell you, when you're negotiating, you should probably negotiate bearing in mind the real strength of your case. And, you know, and oftentimes the lawyer for that party is going to be sitting there nodding their head going, I've been telling you that all this time. You're overplaying your hand. We should resolve that. Mediation is a facilitated negotiation which is completely confidential. If the mediation is not successful, everything gets shredded. Nothing is admissible other than there may have been an offer to settle, which becomes important in terms of costs later on. Arbitration is not mediation. It is not a negotiation. Arbitration is a formalized process like this, where instead of you have a trial judge, you have what's called an arbitrator. Now, often in arbitrations, it's not that the arbitrator comes up with their own reasons, depends on what kind of arbitration it is. It might be one side presents a position and the other side presents a position, and the mediator or the arbitrator just has to say, this one's right and that one's wrong. Except this. I don't accept that, and I'll give you reasons. That works in like commercial disputes. Oftentimes, arbitrators are like private courts. We say to them, design a process together with us, where it kind of mimics this. There will be some form of a pleading. There will be some kind of information exchange and cross-examination or examination under oath. But then we're just going to get to the point where there's this hearing, and you're going to design the hearing, and I, as the arbitrator, am going to do whatever you want. But I'm going to be guided by the rules respecting evidence and administrative law, procedural fairness, so that we'll go through a private trial, and then I will give a decision. Now, arbitration obviously is limited to by the kinds of remedies an arbitrator can give. If you want an injunction, you can't go to arbitration because an arbitrator has no power, no jurisdiction to order an injunction. Only a superior court judge can do that. So arbitration is not going to do it. But for a money dispute, which is, 80% of disputes, arbitration kind of works really well. And so in commercial dealings, like you have commercial actors that are, have a contract or something, they'll say, the hell with this civil litigation system. Like, I'm not interested in that. I don't want to wait 2 years. Let's design our own process, and it'll go before an arbitrator. And all of those click-through contracts that you all agree to about software and websites and this and that, if you look through it, most of them have arbitration agreements that are set out in it saying, if you dispute something, send us notice and we'll all go to Delaware or somewhere and we'll arbitrate our dispute there. Arbitration is its own little world, and it really works well for some kinds of disputes. It doesn't work well for things that involve people, if I can put it that way, where there are personal disputes rather than sort of commercial, contractual things like that. Arbitration doesn't work all that well, although it does work really well for property division and support issues between spouses and family law, particularly where there's high net worth individuals that want to keep all of their financial records out of the public domain, because if they put it into a court, it's all, the public has access to it unless a judge issues what's called a sealing order and literally seals the court file from inspection. And it's very hard to get a sealing order other than where it involves children. Beyond that, or trade secrets. Beyond that, pretty well, we respect the principle of public access. And so if you go to court, all the documents that you file, if somebody's got the court file number, they can go down to the court, pay the fee, get copies of everything. So litigation, arbitration, negotiation / mediation are all different ways of resolving disputes. This is the most brutal amongst them. Okay. How's that?
That's fantastic. This one relies on the adversarial principle. Mediation would not.
Oh, sure.
It does. They all rely
on it. All of these are parties have opposing things.
Okay.
In mediation, though, because it is a facilitated negotiation, in context, a mediator might be able to convince the parties to stop acting as adversaries.
Okay.
And this is sometimes, there is a, I don't think it's a successful model, but there is a model of family law called collaborative law, which is where the parties are, the lawyers are lawyers for both parties. I don't understand how anybody could be a lawyer for both parties, but that's a different story. Or you go to mediation and the mediator says, listen, why don't we all, instead of talking about your rights, why don't we just talk about the best interest of your children?
Yeah.
And make everything about their best interests. So now, instead of you fighting with each other, why don't we just advocate for what's the best interest of the children, and let's agree that at every stage we're going to agree that whatever's in their best interest is what we're going to do. And for some people, that works. They're usually the people that don't go to court anyways, because they go out for coffee like human beings and resolve their disputes. The adversarial principle recognizes that parties have opposing interests and are not able to resolve their dispute cooperatively. They need someone else to resolve it. And what we say, the reason that we prize the adversarial principle, whether it's criminal law, family law, civil litigation, is we say that the person that's making the dispute should have the best of everything. The best arguments, the best evidence, the best procedure, the best. You do your best, and then I'll have the best to choose from. But the difficulty is cost. The adversarial principle means that everything can be fought over at every single stage, but cost of the contest can balloon. So far, so good? Any questions? Yeah?
So can we conclude that if I have a commercial litigation, it's safe to go in front of an arbitral tribunal rather than a national court?
I would suggest for commercial disputes, particularly that are contractually based, that arbitration is a much more cost-effective way to resolve those disputes compared to litigation. Not always. Arbitration often works well because where the parties they have a problem, but they don't want to blow up their relationship. So let's say that you have a manufacturer and a distributor of goods. They still want to do business with one another, but they have a dispute. litigation really does make them lock horns in a way that arbitration can avoid. The arbitrator can say, can focus and say, we're only dealing with whether you're permitted to open this franchise here or not. And so let's just resolve this dispute and then everybody can go along and life is good. Litigation has an unfortunate result of destroying relationships. Anything else? You're gonna have to scream.
So, looking at the diagram up there again, the three major stages that would be like pleading, discovery, trial. Those are the three. Okay.
Anything else? If you bear this in mind as we go along, you'll never get lost because you'll understand at every stage what the point of the process that we're talking about is. So the adversarial principle. I talked about that. There's a couple of cases that I asked you to read. They're not hugely significant, but they are, I think, important in terms of principle. And in the lecture notes that I posted on the webpage, I've given you extracts to them, both Supreme Court of Canada cases and both BC cases. One is the Attorney General of BC against Christie, and the other is the Trial Lawyers Association of BC against the BC Attorney General. And these cases deal with points about access to justice. The Christie case is a significant case. It deals with the right to counsel. There is no constitutionally mandated right to have the benefit of legal advice. Generally or at trial. You have no constitutional right to a lawyer. In certain circumstances, the charter does guarantee you access to legal services in certain situations, like the ability to consult legal aid counsel when you've been detained. The courts have established that. Is there a right to be represented by a lawyer when you're charged with a crime? No. Go to the Ontario court and watch criminal proceedings. It's one of the by the liquor store downtown. If you've never been, you should probably go and watch what we used to call provincial court. It's where most criminal proceedings take place. It's for minor crimes, air driving, theft, assault, stuff like that. You can get major time, you know, up to a couple of years. You'll see that about half of the people are not represented by lawyers. Legal aid is available increasingly for very serious offenses. Should we require people to have the benefit of legal advice in order to navigate this really complicated, really expensive, really arcane system that requires lawyers and judges to sometimes have extensive proceedings to figure out what some rule is and how it should apply? Answer that came from the Supreme Court of Canada, no. Why? Costs too much money. The Supreme Court of Canada is not going to tell the government what to spend money on, except in certain cases. In Christie, the Supreme Court of Canada said, so Christie is a lawyer that takes claims that sometimes are very controversial. And the BC government brings in tax on legal services. And we have a bunch of these kinds of things in Ontario too. Not just filing fees. There are all kinds of little surcharges here and there that are imposed on litigants to fund the system. And he says, well, I act for people and I send them bills and my clients are often poor and so like maybe I'll get paid, maybe I won't get paid. I mean, I can decide as a business person whether to waive those charges by the end of the year because I would have to pay income tax on it, which is a whole different other story. But why should I be liable to pay the tax on legal services for my clients that can't afford to pay it. Don't they have a right to legal representation, which this tax is undermining? The only point that was before the court went away up to the Supreme Court of Canada was the charter point. Is there a charter right to be represented by a lawyer in civil proceedings before a court? Supreme Court of Canada says no. The rule of law means many things. It does not require each litigant to have the benefit of counsel. Yeah, they should. Yeah, it would be ideal. If you can afford it and you don't get a lawyer, you're a fool. Crazy. Don't sue in that case. I mean, if you are going to participate in this system without an expert behind you, you're not going to do well. Does the charter mandate that you have a lawyer? No. In specific instances, the charter might mandate you have a lawyer, and that might be decided upon by a trial court. So a judge in a criminal court might say, I'm going to order the Attorney General to make available a lawyer. Why? Based on the severity of the crime. You're going to be charged with a serious criminal offense. You're going to get legal aid. Can't get legal aid, the court's going to appoint a lawyer for you. It's fundamentally unfair to make a person defend themselves on an extortion charge without a lawyer. Also, it undermines the integrity of our system of justice. And it's probably going to lead to very expensive appeals where the person doesn't defend themselves properly or the proceedings get screwed up as a result. And so it makes a lot of sense to then say there's a charter right under Section 7 or Section 10B or both for a right to counsel. But there is no right to counsel in civil proceedings per se. The trial lawyer's case deals with hearing charges. Very expensive to fund our system, right? You go to the court, there's the building, there's the court staff, there's the security, there's the judges. It's all very, 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 very expensive. How do we fund it? Well, we fund it through general taxation. Should we be able to take some of the costs and offload it to the parties? Well, in theory, that makes sense. You know, the BC statute is drawn on some American statutes, which say that, well, let's say the litigants are successful large businesses. Shouldn't they have to pay the full freight of their dispute? Let's make them pay. Supreme Court of Canada, in this case, has said that charges that are imposed on the parties that limit their access to justice are presumptively invalid. The BC charges that were going to be leveled for court time didn't allow for those charges to be waived and were pretty hefty to begin with. And so the Supreme Court kind of struck it down. In Ontario, we don't have fees for hearing days. You don't pay for a day of court time. What we have are filing fees for documents. You file a statement of claim, you have to pay. You file a statement of defense, you have to pay. You file a notice of motion, you have to pay. You file a notice of appeal, you have to pay. There's a whole bunch of filing fees for different things. Those fees can be waived on application to the court for an indigent party. Just because you don't have money doesn't mean that you're going to be prevented from having access to justice. In the lecture notes, and I think on the webpage, I've given you some links, including to the forms that are available. I'm not testing on it, just so you know that they're out there. The system does regulate itself in that way. There are other fees that you are going to pay as lawyers. You're going to find that you have to pay a surcharge, which helps fund the court system. You have to pay charges to law firms in respect of your insurance premiums or the law society. Everybody's got their hand out when it comes to litigation. At every stage, there are not just the costs of the lawyers, there are usually some add-on costs that help fund the system, but there's relief against them. We have not embraced hearing charges. At some point in the future, we are going to have hearing charges for commercial disputes. because the principle is the right is correct. Why should wealthy corporations get legal get access to the courts for free? Like, they should have access to the courts, but why should you have not pay? I mean, if you go to arbitration, you pay there. If you go to the court, we pay. There's not enough money for everything. And so at some point, when we can figure out a fair system of how to do this, we'll probably have some form of hearing charges, but that won't affect people. Am I out of time? No, 10 more minutes. But because it's so difficult to design a system that doesn't, as a unwanted consequence, limit the ability of private litigants to go to court, we have said that hearing charges are out of bounds, and any charge that's going to be imposed has to have a matching ability to waive the charge where the party can otherwise pay. Okay? Access to justice. What else do I got? Right, the rules. Well, I've already told you what the rules are last time. The intellectual notes, on the first page, I have set out probably the most important rule in the rules of civil procedure. It's the rule that tells you what the point of all of this stuff is. These rules shall be liberally construed to secure the just, most expeditious, and least expensive determination of every civil proceeding on its merits. Those are three separate values. When courts are called upon to give orders, make orders, give directions, interpret and to apply rules, lawyers and judges are always going to go back to this point, which is that these rules should be construed and applied, certainly faithful to their text. You can't depart from the rule itself, but there's a lot of discretion involved. What do we want? We want a just determination that is fair. The party should be treated fairly. Most expeditious. Let's get on with this. Like, hurry it up. If it's going to take a year, I don't want to allow that. If we're going to give you 30 days, most expeditious. Timely justice is important. Least expensive. Litigants will try to use economic power against each other. Party with deep pockets is always going to say, oh yes, Your Honor, we want to have them produce to us all of their Facebook posts for the last 15 years, plus their emails, plus this, plus that. And just go, obviously you're just trying to cause the other side to go bankrupt. How much do you really need? How about 1 year's worth? Right? Least expensive. Like, what we'll do here? Right? We have to find a way of allowing the parties to present their cases, but in applying these rules, what do we want? A determination on the merits in a process that is just, fair, expeditious, timely, and economically efficient. If you bear that in mind when you're applying the rules, when you're giving advice, when you're taking a position before a court, and you say to the judge, I'm going to keep coming back to this. I know I'm really dealing with Rule 25.11 with respect to the substantive adequacy of the pleading. However, in applying the rule, I'm going to ask Your Honor to have regard for Rule 1.04(1). Just, most expeditious, least expensive, music to the judge's ears. Absolute music to the judge's ears. Judges want to make orders that are going to keep things running. Let's keep the trains running, but let's do it in a way that's fair and does not break the bank. All of this is supposed to be about fairness. It's supposed to be about allowing the parties to know the case they have to meet, have access to the evidence that they need to understand what the other side case is and to present their case, and then ultimately present all of that to a decision maker fairly. That's what it's all about. Even though you've got all of these arcane procedures that we have to go through along the way, Rule 1.04 sub 1 is the most important rule in the rules of civil procedure, and you'll see it referenced again and again and again and again as judges try to get parties to stop being adversaries and wearing themselves out by picking procedural points to cause the other party to go bankrupt or to slow things down. So as we go along and we're looking at individual rules and we're looking at cases where there's a dispute, bear in mind this is like, it's not like automatic, like a computer program. We have to take these rules and apply them with some sensitivity to the context of an individual case. Any questions about any of that? So this is the second class, right? First week. So for the one-third of the people that I won't see till the last week before the exam, have a nice term. Whatever it is that you're going to be doing, I hope you enjoy doing it. When you come back, I'm going to say, I hope you've been doing the readings. One more thing. I'm doing this recording business as accommodation short term. After the accommodation is over, I'm not doing the recordings anymore. I don't like the recordings, and I'll tell you why. It's not just because, you know, I'm being a bastard. Like that, you can take that for granted. One, I'm not the IT department, and I don't like doing it because I screw it up. That's the first thing. The second, if you're going to like say, I want to have access to the recordings because I'd really like to listen to the lecture 16 times, don't do that. If you're having problems with the materials, if you're struggling with the material, first of all, I encourage you to ask questions in class because you're all very smart. And if you're having a problem, everybody else is having a problem. But beyond that, email me. I'd be happy to see you outside of class. We can set up a Zoom meeting. We can set up a phone call. It's much better use of your time to talk to me to resolve the problems than listening to me drone on again for 90 minutes. Like, I wouldn't want that the first time. I can understand them. The third of the people are going to go, the hell with this. I'll just do all the reading on my own. I'll see you in the last week. Maybe you'll give me the exam questions. Yeah, I get that. Fine. If you're struggling, don't think that you're like out there alone in the world. I might make you like read something to me, like read something and come back to me, or I might give you a question, even ask you to prepare a written answer, or if you say something like, I haven't read the case, so I'm gonna give you that look, like, you know, your parent would give you like plenty of nuts. You know, go to bed. I'll tell you, why don't you go read the case and then come back and tell me what it says. But if you're struggling, I don't want you to read, to go and sit and watch the classes again. I don't think it's an efficient use of your time. And frankly, since we've been doing these recordings since COVID, student performance has dropped off. It really has. I don't think it is a good way to learn. I think that if you're watching these lectures at home, you're easily distracted. You don't really pay attention as much. You're not really in the moment. And it's not an efficient use of your time. So if you've been here and you want the recording to go over it, I'm not really keen on that. I would much rather see you one-on-one and help you through the problem that you're having. See you next week. Have a very nice day.